Evening, ladies and gentlemen. Great pleasure to be here. I have no slides, and I'm always following Sally in the recent months, so it's always a difficult task to take. So I usually have to write the talk during Sally's talk, so make sure I don't just say the same things, and I've had to do that again. A little bit of my own background. I'm going to say three things around antimicrobial resistance. One is highlight a little bit about what I think the major problem is. Secondly, where I think we need to go next and where research needs to go. And then thirdly, what is the role for governments and non-governmental agencies, intergovernmental agencies, World Health Organization and others. But I'll perhaps start on a personal level, which is my own background, which was originally trained in neurology, actually, for some reason, but then went into infectious diseases. But one of the sort of points of my career, which really I think made a difference to me more than anything else, was working as a junior doctor in London, in this city, in the mid-1980s, at the start, really, of the HIV epidemic. And any clinician who was working at that stage worked through a phase which most of our generation in this room, the generation stretch a bit in this room, I appreciate that, but most people in this room wouldn't have worked in an era when you could not treat an infection on a regular basis. And that HIV, during the mid-1980s, before retroviral therapy came into being, was really life-changing. Individuals, mostly young, mostly male in London, were dying of things that you could not treat. And the thought of going back to that in a wider population is really a terrifying thought, whether it's in HIV or anything else. And then the last 18 years, where I've been living in Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam and in working essentially in infectious diseases, including with some colleagues here in the audience, has also brought it home to you that this is not something that will happen to your grandchildren or after that, but this is actually happening now. And although I absolutely applaud what Dame Sally has done, and she has led the world in this space, we have had a lot of reports going back quite a long time. And as Sally said, actually Fleming, just up the road from here, predicted this, and Sally gave the quote. The other quote that she didn't use, which I think is also crucial, Fleming also said that you shouldn't worry too much about going to bigger doses in these diseases, because these will target the microbes and not the human beings. And one of the lessons I learned from medical school was you should use a single drug at the lowest possible dose for the shortest time, is some of the worst advice you could give in infectious diseases. I think generically we should be using the biggest dose, including loading doses, and we should never use drugs in single, because combination therapy will reduce the chance of getting resistance. So what is the problem? Well, Sally's been through some of it. This is happening here in London now. It's not just something happening in poor people in developing countries, and we do not need to worry about. What happens in Delhi will affect London tomorrow, but London is generating its own problems in intensive care units now. 25,000 people a year, you heard. It's probably considerably more than that, because most people don't get a diagnosis. We're still weak at diagnosing infections, and when we do, we're not sure what it means. This will come to the UK, whether from outside or inside, and it is truly global. So what you do in the UK, if you don't do it at a global level, will only have marginal benefit, and we've got to think globally. And the last comment, I think, on this is that we are in a honeymoon phase. Most of the clinicians in the audience will have been through the microbial era, and people, a generation, if I take my mother, who's 91, she would have been one of the people that came through before that era, and we have gone through a honeymoon phase. It is across all types of bacteria, it's across humans, it's across animals, it's from young children and babies, pregnant women, all the way through to the end of life and very senior individuals. And it is geographically everybody. And it covers, and this is a critical point, this is not just the preserve of infectious disease specialists. Oncology would be impossible without antimicrobial agents. It would be impossible to do routine surgery without antimicrobial agents, and childbirth would become, again, a devastating risk, a huge risk. My own work, mostly in things like malaria, typhoid, TB, and HIV in Vietnam, all of those are affected, and all of those could be relevant here. We have misused, we have also not valued antibiotics over the last three or four decades. We've thought they're here forever, and we haven't really appreciated the value in the same way, I believe, that we've appreciated the value of, for instance, chemotherapeutic agents or of other lines of medicine. We've had antibiotics, and we've not thought we had to worry about them. We've hugely neglected certain areas, I think, of medicine, particularly microbiology and pharmacology, and those two joined together. You cannot see drug resistance in the isolated world of the microbiologist or even the infectious disease physician. You have to see it in the way that you use those drugs and the interaction between the drug and the body and the microbe. And the coming together and the lack, in the UK of real centres of excellence in pharmacology outside one or two centres is, I think, one of the major problems and something we do need to address. The other thing is the world is changing, and it's changing in two particular ways. One is we are getting fatter, and yet largely we're using the same doses that we used in empiric designs many years ago. And if you do weigh a certain weight, if you're 50, 60 kilos, and you're using the same doses in somebody that may be 120 kilos, there is a pharmacological issue there, and we haven't addressed that. We haven't gone back and studied enough of the pharmacological profile of many of the drugs and the penetration of those drugs into critical sites of action. Just measuring drug levels in the blood will only get you so far if the infection is in the brain or is in the deep lung tissues. And until we go back and rebuild some of our chemistry and our pharmacology and make sure pharmacologists and microbiologists talk to each other, I don't think we will get over the problem. And then there's the abuse angle, and we've often heard and we've blamed GPs, I think somewhat unfairly sometimes, but there are other areas of abuse. In Vietnam, in China, and increasingly in the West, you're seeing the rise of counterfeit drugs. And the whole regulation around drugs is absolutely critical to ensure that supply. If you have a drug with no antibiotic in, then that is terrible for the patient. The patient may die as a result of that. But even worse in some ways for the population is when you may have a little bit of an antibiotic in or an antiviral drug in. If you can imagine a counterfeit market in the antiretroviral drugs, where you may have 5 or 10% of the antiretroviral drug in that compound you're giving, and that individual would take it for the rest of their life, potentially, you wouldn't know necessarily week to week, month to month, that you were taking a counterfeit drug, because you wouldn't have your viral loads measured, you wouldn't have the PK, etc., pharmacology done. So that is something we have to address. Moving on to the research agenda, I think this does have to become centre stage, and again, pay tribute to the way this has been led from the Department of Health. But I think the funding agencies, including the Wellcome Trust, need to take this much more seriously and need to interact with the pharmaceutical industry much, much more closely. I think we do need to move away from closed doors here. And at the early stage of the preclinical, I think that does have to become a non-competitive stage where we're looking at targets, and the academic sector has to understand what a target is and what a good target is and what a druggable target is. And unless we get academics and industry to work together and share the same coffee rooms, I don't think we're going to break that logjam about academics seeing a target which actually in reality isn't. My sort of world doesn't know what a good target is, and unless we reach with industry, I don't think we will. I do think we need to rebuild centres of excellence in microbiology, but they have to be linked with pharmacology and chemistry and industry and basic science. An area that I hope will build, and this is coming with the Department of Health, we have not yet made the economic argument around this group of compounds. The economic cost of doing nothing, but also the economic opportunities of doing something and changing the way we work. And that is going to need a change in the incentive system that allows drugs to be developed. You cannot use the current market model, which works very well for statins, works very well for long-term treatment studies, or where you value the product hugely, as in oncology. Those models won't work for an area where you may need to not use a drug. You may need to keep it back, or you may only need to give it for a week. And I think we're going to have to look at the regulation, the business models, and critically, this is where government can play a role, the incentives around the development of antimicrobials. And there are things you can do. There are advanced purchases. There are things you can do around patents that would encourage incentives. And I do believe the pharma industry has not got out of this space for any other reason than they don't see a business model in it. I do think there's huge interest in this. It's just that they cannot see the incentives. We absolutely have to work on the social science and behaviour issues. We've heard about access to drugs and access to antibiotics and behavioural issues, but unless we really understand the drivers of that, this won't just be solved by a biomedical approach, I believe. It does need to change of behaviour in the way we seek advice and we seek antibiotics. And on this area, the last thing I'll say is I think we have to think outside the box. There are areas of great interest which have not really come to the West yet. Phages, which are viruses that affect bacteria, huge interest in the old states of the Soviet Union. And we've essentially ignored that, the development of those products, and we need to embrace that sort of out-of-the-box thinking. Antibodies as therapy in infectious diseases, I think, should be resuscitated as an area of interest. And finally, perhaps the biggest argument, in my view, for the development investment in future vaccines is the coming of antimicrobial resistance. We will never stay ahead of whichever infection you choose, HIV, TB, malaria, if we're only going to rely on pharmacology. We do need pharmacology and we do need drugs, but you're absolutely going to, at some point, have to have vaccines for those big killer diseases if we're not going to fall behind. Role of government, I've mentioned incentives and the pathway to approval. I think the current pathway of regulation around new antimicrobial agents is far too difficult. The proof of concept, the proof of phase three trials of a new agent is too difficult to get to. The use of combinations is not encouraged because of the way we regulate the industry. And I think this is where government has to act, including with the incentives around really valuing this group of drugs, volumes, patents, and advanced purchasing, and the pathway to regulation. Last comment is going to be around the World Health Organization and the role of the intergovernmental agencies, where this is where Sally and I may disagree on various aspects. I worry about the WHO's ability in a world which is not just about human health, but is also about animal health and is also about business and the incentives. And all of that, I believe, has to go together. I just worry about the World Health Organization's ability to deliver what we need in this space and question whether in those structures, which were set up in the 1940s and 50s with a different mandate and a different approach, are fit for purpose for delivering this cross-sectorial, intergovernmental, global issues. And I believe we may need a new paradigm for thinking about this, which goes beyond a single issue of human health. The international health regulations have been put there to respond to epidemics, and we all got frightened by, and many of us lived through SARS and bird flu and the pandemic. And the international health regulations have been mandated where, in theory, the WHO now has some teeth to ensure that countries do report. I think the WHO's great strength, which is they represent all governments, is also its greatest weakness in the sense that they therefore have to reach a compromise on everything and all 186 or 193 countries have to agree. And that leads to a compromise which, in the end, ends up with a totally watered-down set of principles. So the international health regulations, in principle, are fantastic in the sense that if something happens in London today, you have to report it to the World Health Organization. But remind everybody that we're 20 months in to the MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. We don't yet know what the source is. We don't know how many humans have been infected. We don't know the mortality rate. We haven't randomized a single patient to a treatment study. We have no vaccine in development. And we're just very, very lucky that this virus is slowly evolving and hasn't gone quick. I think we need a much quicker ability to respond to these issues, both clinical and mandated with real teeth, rather than a talking shop in another part of Europe. And on that, I'll finish. Thank you very much.